From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nigut. The Georgia branch of the ACLU came out of the legislative session celebrating victories, but discouraged by a number of measures that passed. One, the expansion of incarcerations that require cash bond for release. ACLU Georgia Executive Director Andrea Young joins us today.
I'm Tia Mitchell. Georgia Congressman Mike Collins is facing criticism for his social media once again, this time for appearing to co-sign a video of an Ole Miss student making racist sounds and gestures towards a pro-Palestine protester.
Plus, there's nothing new, of course, about the widespread demonstrations taking place on college campuses, those that are peaceful and those that have provoked violence. AJC reporter Ernie Suggs is here to put the current protest in historical context. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Tia, a brand new week. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Happy Monday.
Yeah, happy Monday. Tia, let's spend a couple minutes. We'll bring in our first guest in just a moment and let her join our conversation. But you, Greg Bluestein, and I, of course, Friday, the last time we were on the air, invited 4 students from Metro Atlanta colleges to come in and talk about what was happening on college campuses in Georgia and, of course, across the country. And we had a couple of students very much believe in the protests as being important statements about the need for an independent Palestinian state. We had a student from Georgia Tech who was the president of their Hillel chapter there, who was a little concerned about some of the language that was being used. So we thought that we should talk about it for just a couple of minutes, Tia. And I'll, if you don't mind, let me start it off. I've said on this time, I'm Jewish, and I've said on this show on any number of occasions that I am troubled by the way in which Prime Minister Netanyahu and his far-right government are prosecuting the war, that it troubles me that they are taking an all-out war approach that is decimating Palestinian cities, and most important, taking away sympathy from the horrendous October 7th massacres inflicted by Hamas soldiers on Israelis, and in fact shifted world opinion toward Gaza. So I've said that all along. But I'm also was troubled at how easily the students talked about genocide, that Israel is committing a genocide against the Palestinians. And the reason that worries me is, of course, it was a real genocide, the Holocaust, that led to the founding of Israel as a Jewish state, a safe haven for Jews, which at the same time, to complicate matters, pushed the Palestinians out of their territory. So it's very complicated. And I just felt that you and I should talk about it for a couple minutes.
Yeah, Bill. And number one, I want to start out, number one, thanking those students. You know, live radio isn't easy. They're young people. They're just now forming their own opinions and outlooks on politics. And to ask them for an hour to talk about their lived experience, but also they gave really, really insightful and well-informed political commentary. And I think we didn't know which way the conversation was going to go. So it was not as easy to prep them because we didn't know. And so they rolled with us. And I just really commend them, commend their universities and their families for raising such smart young people. But we're learning. This was our first time, you know, doing something like that. So we appreciate, we've got some feedback, and I want to say I appreciate those listeners and continue to send us your feedback. But I will say, as someone who's not Jewish, I've tried to learn not just about the rhetoric and the word genocide, for example. I literally was like looking up the definition of genocide. But also listen, because this has to do with, you know, lived experience and, like, you know, listening to you, Bill, when you talk about Jewish people as a religion, but also as an ethnicity and as a culture, having ties to a nation that is very unique. And so we can't ignore those emotional bonds, mm-hmm. those generational bonds that Jewish people have with Israel that makes this more personal than just geopolitical conflict.
Yeah.
But I will say, I do want to say this, Bill. I think that I literally looked up the definition of genocide, and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum says one of the five categories of genocide is deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Mm. And I think people, as they research what is happening in Israel's conflict with Hamas and how that's affecting Gaza, and they read, you know, that Palestinian people were pushed to South Gaza and cities like Rafah, and now that Israel is considering invading Rafah, I think they get to genocide as a conclusion. I'm not saying they're right or they're wrong, but I'm saying I think when you look at the words and you look at what's happening, I think people, again, it's wrong to say Jewish people want genocide of Palestinians, but I think there are people who look at what the state of Israel, what Netanyahu, the decisions he's making, and say it looks like genocide.
Yeah, it's very, we should point out, and then we'll move past this, we should point out that on Friday, our goal was to give the students their own voice. It was not our job on Friday to criticize, to push back. We thought that our listeners deserved a chance to hear what people are saying on college campuses here in Georgia and around the country. And that's why you and I are now kind of doing a little bit of a look back on all that. And we should also point out very quickly and then move on that this past week we also, on Wednesday, had Dov Wilker, the executive director of the American Jewish Committee, talk about how strongly he believes Israel must answer the October 7th massacre and try to do its best to destroy Hamas. And then on the day after, I had Ruwa Roman, the only Palestinian-American legislator in the General Assembly. So we are trying as hard as we can, as long as this is an issue, to make sure that voices are heard. Mm-hmm. Okay? Fair enough?
Yes.
All right. Then let's bring in our guest, a very special guest, who I'm so happy accepted our invitation to be here. She is the executive director of the Georgia ACLU and has been for the past 7 years, Andrea Young. Andrea, we're so glad you could be with us. Thanks very much.
Well, great. Happy Monday. And great to be here with you and Tia.
So, Andrea, as long as we were talking about the protests on campus, you published a piece in the AJC at the end of very end of last month in which you offered your opinion about what was happening on college campuses. And essentially, you can tell us yourself, but essentially you said these demonstrations need to go forward unfettered unless there's terrible violence that breaks out.
Well, yes, of course, you know, I grew up in the civil rights movement, which was, you know, one nonstop demonstration.
We should point out your dad is Ambassador right. Andrew Young.
And also as ACLU, we take a very strong stand that if we are to continue to be a democracy, we have to have a way for voices to be heard. And we have, you know, worked out, I think, a good understanding of nonviolent protest. And so what we have, and I personally, as a college student, protested decisions of my my college on tenure and so forth. So, you know, and of course, Atlanta, you know, has a long history, Atlanta student movement and so forth. So I think it's integral to our democracy. I really commend you for having the voices of the students, because I think we don't hear what the students are saying. You know, we get third and fourth hand, we get news about the response, but not the voices of the students themselves and what, you know, what their concerns are.
Well, mm-hmm. T, I want to bring you in, but before I do, real quick, Andrea, you, mm-hmm. you offered some guidelines mm-hmm. for protecting mm-hmm. free expression mm-hmm. on campuses, mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with First Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. But here's the one that I was particularly interested in. Mm-hmm. You tell college administrators, weigh the lasting impact of protesters being yes. charged with crimes
yes.
that carry enhanced penalties.
Yes.
These enhancements were designed and are being used to punish yes. dissent. And you're specifically yes. really, without naming him, talking about Governor Kemp and Attorney General Chris Carr, who have pushed for these enhanced penalties against protesters.
So the whole time that I have been at the ACLU, myself and Chris Bruce, our policy director, we have been fighting to keep open the space for peaceful protest. And there have been bills, every session has bills that say, if you do something during a protest, gets an enhanced penalty that would include trespass, a number of other things. So, you know, we're very concerned about this enhancement, you know, of penalties. And of course, in our, you know, in our system, once you get an arrest, you know, it's in the system. You know, it is something that will follow these kids around for a very long time. And so we say the bar should be violence, you know, if that don't call the police on a nonviolent protest. Mm. Don't, you know, and you see what happens when you call police, you're calling for an armed response. And so we're saying, you know, if that should be a last resort, certainly not something that you do, you know, during an otherwise nonviolent protest.
Tia, you want to jump in?
So I do, because one of the things, going back to those four students, they stressed it during the live show, but when we chatted with them after the show, they emphasized that the protests were peaceful, disruptive, as in, you know, not campus per usual, protests in some campuses. We know there were building takeovers, but there was no violence until police arrived. And they said it was police who were violent towards the protesters in making arrests and things like that. And so, Andrea, I wanted you kind of touched on it, but you mentioned that when you were growing up, campus protests did happen. I was like, is it a HBCU? And I'm sorry, I'm not familiar what school you went to, but I was like, I don't know a HBCU that didn't have like a campus protest that included a building takeover. Because every HBCU I know has had that in their history. But I said, maybe that's a HBCU thing. But can you talk about that? And just, are you concerned that the violence so far at these campus protests has largely been pointed to as either police when making arrests, or in the case of Ole Miss, that it was, and at I believe
UCLA.
One of the schools in California, yeah,
UCLA.
That it was the counter protesters that became violent.
Yeah, I mean it's deeply disturbing, and of course, whenever you call the police, it's going to be your black and brown students that they look at and say, okay, who's not. Who doesn't belong here, right? So we still have that overlay of racial targeting. Of course, there's a dramatic photograph of a professor at Emory, you know, on the ground, being handcuffed. And so, you know, we really strongly, you know, wanted to urge college campuses, do not call the police on you. They have extensive security forces themselves, you know, people who maybe know the students, have more interaction with them. There are certainly faculty and administrators. And I just want to say, as a parent, these schools cost a lot of money, you know, and the idea that their response to a peaceful protest is to call the police, you know, I personally, you know, find that offensive as a parent. And I think the other thing is that, though, they also have to have viewpoint neutrality. So however you respond to protests on one perspective, you should be consistent and not treat some ideas differently than other ideas.
We should point out that there has now been a great deal of criticism of how quickly administrators at Emory called police when there was an attempt there. The initial attempt was to set up essentially a tent encampment on campus, mimicking in some ways Columbia University. And one of the things that led to the police being called quickly was there was misinformation. That misinformation being, Andrea, that some of these protesters had nothing to do with Emory. They were anti-police training center protesters who had caused trouble and violence in other settings. So administrators moved quickly to bring in police. It led to confrontation. And it was only later that President Fenves had to acknowledge and apologize because there weren't outside activists. It was Emory students. And that wound has not gone away on that campus.
Yeah, and to his credit that he has apologized. I do think you can also ignore the impact here of having congressional hearings that resulted in, you know, presidents of major universities being fired. And so I think that there is, you know, there is this the sort of authoritarianism sometimes that issues from some parts of Washington, I think, has also trickled down into this. But I just want to say our great universities are not supposed to be country clubs. They're supposed to be places where people learn to engage in, you know, debating ideas, having very strongly held views, talking about the evidence, the facts. And so, you know, again, this is also a teaching opportunity for our universities, for our colleges, to say, how do we work through these very difficult issues that people of goodwill can have different opinions?
Tia?
It's so interesting. I don't talk about this much publicly, but when I was a student at FAMU, we spent the night in the Capitol. Part of the protests over voting rights access during the 2000 presidential election. And also at FAMU, we marched like once a year over something or another. Sometimes it was state policy towards HBCUs. There was a bombing on campus and we marched about safety, like literal safety, because someone had bombed our school. And then again, we marched after the 2000 election because students had complained about being turned away at the polls. And at the time, we didn't think anyone was going to arrest us. You know what I mean? And that was the state capitol that we spent the night in. So it's just interesting to see how the response has changed over the years. And I think Andrea does make a point that perhaps that's the point, you know, when you pull presidents of universities on the national stage in front of Congress and they see that if they don't take a certain stance, they may be out of a job, then that may change the way they approach protests moving forward.
So, Andrea, we want to turn in a moment to talk about some of the things that happened in the legislature that were on your mind at ACLU. But real quickly, before we do, one last thing about the protests. You grew up in a household where your father was one of the great civil rights leaders. You watched him as he engaged in his activities. And there is one slight difference that I would throw out here, which was that your dad, Dr. King, Dr. Abernathy, all the others, they understood nonviolent protest. When police came in to arrest them, They had the courage to sit down and accept arrest. They did not fight back. They did not look to engage in a violent way because Dr. King's entire movement was nonviolence. And it strikes me that today the atmosphere is somewhat different in some cases, not all. But it does seem to me that nonviolence needs to be continually taught to young people if they're going to engage in protests.
Well, you know, the legislature passed a classroom censorship bill. It makes it difficult to talk about this history, to talk about the theory behind it. And, you know, of course, these were people who studied and practiced. I mean, the SNCC protesters in Nashville studied for 6 months.
Yeah.
They studied nonviolence before. So I think it's unreasonable to expect college campuses, you know, college students to have the same sort of rigor and philosophical, you know, as Dr. King. These, you know, Dr. King, my dad, you know, they had degrees in ministry, and Dr. King, of course, had a doctorate. You know, so they had deeply, deeply, deeply studied this practice. And I certainly think it's effective practice, but I think it's unrealistic to expect college students.
Let's move on, because I know there are some issues at the legislature, Andrea, that concern you deeply. I think let's start with the fact that Governor Kemp has now signed a bill that increases the number of arrests that qualify for or require cash bail. What's wrong with that, Andrea?
Well, you know, this is bad policymaking. You may recall that in 2018, Governor Deal signed this bail reform. This is a result of, you know, 7 years of statewide hearings, stakeholder meetings, that this was crafted. And so it's cruel, it's costly, and it's counterproductive. It's cruel. Nathan Deal was weeping when he signed this bill because he knew the impact it would have on Georgia families. Because, of course, when someone is arrested and your family is trying to make bail, it's not just that person. It's their mother. It's their family members. It's their children that are affected, trying to pull together the resources. We're talking about minor crimes because, of course, if the person is deemed a threat to the community, then they don't have to set bail at all. So we're talking about minor crimes. It's costly to the community because jails are expensive. And so keeping people in jail when they have not been convicted, awaiting trial, is very costly and will increase the overcrowding that's already a problem. And it's counterproductive because people who are kept in jail awaiting trial are more likely to reoffend, not less.
Tia?
So, Andrea, let's play, I hate that term, play devil's advocate, but help us get in the minds of, so what is the rationale? Like, you have all these reasons for why expanding cash bail is not just counterproductive, but detrimental. So why would they do it?
So let's look at the process, right? So in a democracy, you know, process is boring, but process is really the thing. So the process by which, you know, the bipartisan, really mostly Republican, led, you know, Criminal Justice Commission made these revisions was a very extensive process. There were hearings with district attorneys. There were hearings with sheriffs. In fact, I understand that a lot of the pressure came from county sheriffs because of the burden it places on their facilities. And so, and the cost to taxpayers. And so, you know, one was a very deliberate, extensive process. It was very public. You know, reports were issued every year and a policy was crafted. This bill just came out of nowhere, and I don't know the rationale because there were no statewide
hearings.
Well, it's
part of Governor Kemp's effort to get tougher on crime, to reverse some of what Nathan Deal accomplished. Yeah. So as an example, just to make sure our listeners understand, this new law adds dozens of offenses, including, for instance, failure to appear in court on a traffic citation, a trespassing, a second trespassing,
a lot of
offense, nonviolent, and what would in many ways be considered very, very minor offenses.
And crimes of poverty, you know, particularly. So there you have the duality, someone who's so poor that maybe they broke in somewhere to sleep, and yet they're expected to pay bail. And so it, you know, and so, but the thing is that you have to have policy based on facts and evidence. And so the facts don't support that this is, so this is maybe a way to be more punitive on crime, which is why I call it cruel, but it's not a way to prevent or reduce crime.
So Governor Kemp tomorrow has until tomorrow to sign or veto measures that are on his desk right now. There are a couple more that you're very interested in. What we're going to do, let's get a break out of the way right now. We'll come back. We have a few more minutes to talk with Andrea Young, and I want to talk about those measures that she is concerned that perhaps Governor Kemp is considering signing. This is Politically Georgia. Tia Mitchell, Andrea Young, and I will be right back.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters to sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. Tia and I are talking to Andrea Young, the executive director of Georgia ACLU. And Andrea, as I mentioned just before the break, there are a couple of measures that are on Governor Kemp's desk at the very end. He's got one more day to sign or veto measures, and there are a couple of them that are of great concern to you. Certainly a fairly comprehensive election bill that has some provisions that trouble you. One of the provisions is that it would expand greatly the ability of anyone to challenge voter registration. Part of that is also the elimination of QR codes, which the Secretary of State's office says would cost millions and millions of dollars to do. You're very concerned about that measure, yes?
Yes. So we call this a Franken bill. It was something that different elements of this bill were considered during the session and then crammed together into a bill at the last minute, the last day of session. And so some of the provisions just are not possible, like, you know, counting all advance and absentee ballots within an hour of the polls closing. You know, this like is not humanly possible. There are harmful changes to unhoused citizens. We already talked about the effect of rolling back bail reform on people who are unhoused. This will make it very difficult for people without housing to be registered and to participate in our political system. And we have to remember some of these people are veterans. I mean, some of them have jobs. They're, you know, members of our community. There's just a number of the challenges which already have been expanded. You know, it was kind of a gray area in Georgia law. Now it's kind of a open season for vigilantes to take lists and issue challenges. We are mostly successful at preventing these challenges, but they eat up a lot of time of our election boards, time that they need to spend on figuring out how to run a smooth election that maximizes participation from our citizens. So, yes, we're very concerned about this bill.
So, Andrea, as you guys at ACLU, with these new laws in mind, but also looking forward to November, what are you guys mostly looking out for when it comes to election protection, ensuring everyone who's eligible is able to cast a vote, things like that?
Well, a lot of what we do, you know, one, we are involved in litigation on a number of previous laws, and we're preparing litigation on this if necessary. But we also stand up our voter access project, where we work with volunteers to work with their own county board of elections to do some of the very complicated, you know, sort of where are polling places? When is Saturday and Sunday voting? How are challenges being managed? You know, are people abiding by the law and by federal law? And so, we are in about 15 counties trying to help and support recruiting poll workers so that we've got some tech-savvy young folks that are helping, you know, in these polls to run these machines. We really want people to understand this is our process, right? These elections work when everybody participates, and that's everybody votes. It's also everybody pitches in to be a poll worker, to just remind your family members and people in your circle that, you know, like there's a primary going on right now. And so this system works when all of us engage in it, and that also helps to build trust.
Well, and in fact, that's one of the reasons I think it's safe to say you oppose the bill, which in fact would give so much more power to individuals to challenge voter registrations of literally hundreds of thousands of people if they wanted to do just that. It's a simple matter, I think, if that bill were to be signed, going on a website and filling out a very quick form.
And it's kind of vigilantism because we have a very robust list maintenance system. In fact, we sued Governor Kemp. We've sued, you know, the Secretary of State over being overly aggressive in removing people from the voter rolls. So it's not as if there's not a very robust, very systematic, Raffensperger is an engineer. You know, he has a very systematic approach to list maintenance. And the role of ordinary citizens when they don't have particular knowledge of a person, I mean, they understand that they are challenging people they don't even know. Which is not, they don't have any particular knowledge. They don't have knowledge that is superior to what the Secretary of State already has and is told.
So I guess my last question would be, what can regular people do? I mean, I know the ACLU is fighting, like you said, litigation and things like that. Is there anything you tell regular people who are worried about it globally or for themselves personally?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you can go to the ACLU's website, acluga.org. We always have voter resources. Also, the Secretary of State has an app and maintains, you know, a voter database around, the elections, where you can vote, what the dates are. And I think most of the people listening are going to themselves be voters, I would assume. Probably, I imagine WABE folks are super voters, but there are plenty of people in your circle, and a lot of people who say, "Well, I don't know if I'm." They really don't know the process. They don't understand. You can register online in Georgia. You know, you do need to have a photo ID for college students. That's your state university ID does function as a voter ID. But people need to understand that democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to be engaged, and we need people to be, you know, sort of, like I say, act like you're going to, you know, you're getting ready for a Beyonce concert, right? Get prepared. Look, your voice and we're as the things that we are talking about, what every person in the state legislature is on the ballot this year, and you see the kinds of things that they decide. And so understand that, you know, your voice is important. Your voice will matter.
You know, we're going to have to get to a break in a minute. But, there are people who say, well, voting is a right. It's a privilege. It's not. It's a responsibility. That seems to me the way you really have to frame a voting. It is something that we have to do.
Yeah, we need everybody to do it. I marched in Selma when I was 9 years old. So I believe in it very. But if there's an election, I will come. And, you know, when people, you know, we're as ACLU, if everybody votes, everybody has a fair opportunity and everybody lives with the result. That's how democracy works.
Andrea Young, it's so great to have had you here. We're going to get to a break right now. I love having you on. Look, I've known your father since 1983. He, to me, is one of my great heroes, and I am proud to call him. He's become a friend, even after I stopped covering him. And so you come from such a great, great family and are continuing that wonderful work, and it's just a privilege to have you in the show. Thanks for being here, Andrea.
Great to be here. Thank
we have
you.
Somebody else really wonderful coming up in just a minute, Tia. Ernie Suggs, AJC reporter, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the history of protests. This is nothing new. You already knew that, but Ernie has some great specifics to put it all into context. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The AJC has a special offer for Politically Georgia podcast listeners. If you subscribe today, you can get 3 months of unlimited digital access for just 99 cents. That's all our breaking news, politics, investigations, business, sports, food, and dining, and much more. Plus, you'll get access to our e-paper, the AJC app, and our assortment of newsletters. So take advantage of this special offer for podcast listeners only by going to ajc.com/starta. That's one word, start A. This introductory special is for new subscribers only. And we are joined now by Ernie Suggs, veteran AJC reporter. He oversees Unapologetically Atlanta. And Ernie, we're so happy to have you here today. And Tia, before we go into what we want to talk to Ernie about specifically today, I think you and I need to congratulate him. He's an Emmy nominee, Tia.
Yeah, go Ernie.
Yeah.
The Ernie prizes come out today, so I figure my 30-year streak of not winning a Pulitzer Prize is I'm happy that the Emmy nomination is here. So well, I appreciate you acknowledging that.
And we should point out that you are a nominee because you are a writer of South Got Something to Say, a really powerful and wonderful documentary about how the hip-hop movement, how Atlanta became the center of the hip-hop movement and one of the wonderful people who were a part of that movement. So again, congratulations,
Ernie. Oh, thank you
very much. Yeah. Tia, you know, you already talked about a little bit with Andrea about the kind of tradition of protest on HBCU campuses. And Ernie, you talk about that in your piece in which you try to put the context, the protests of today into that broader historical context. And you start with a protest at an HBCU. 1924, what happened at Fisk University?
Yeah, 1924. Well, I wanted to write this story that shows that what's happening today is not necessarily new, particularly on college campuses. So I wanted to kind of look at W.E.B. Du Bois, who has a very, very deep connection to Atlanta, but he's also a graduate of Fisk University. So in 1924, Fisk University, a lot of private colleges, a lot of private HBCUs at the time, including Morehouse and Spelman, had white presidents. And Fisk University's president, Fisk Institute's president was white. And in an attempt to raise money and appeal to white philanthropists, he said that his students would no longer focus on liberal arts, but mostly industrial arts. And if you understand industrial arts, and at that time, that was a big theme of Booker T. Washington, Du Bois obviously was very upset about that. He went on campus for his daughter's graduation, which is kind of ironic that the college would even invite him to speak at his daughter's graduation, understanding how upset he was about this decision to change the curriculum. And he encouraged the students to go on strike. So the students went on strike. Half the students left, a lot of the students had fought in World War I, so they were older, they were more mature, they wanted something different. They didn't want to know how to, you know, plow a field. They wanted to learn how to write poetry and do things like that and study classical literature. So they went on strike and they left. And the president ended up leaving the college. Fisk University now, as you know, is one of our leading, Tia will tell you, one of our leading historically black colleges in the country, still is. And that's just an example of just how college campuses are these fertile grounds for ideas and challenging the system. And this was just a perfect example of that. And I go way back since. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to take you way back. And then, T, I want you to jump in. You point out that in 1639, Harvard University was only 3 years old. Students forced out their headmaster, Nathaniel Eaton, number one, because he beat a student too severely. But, Ernie, he also did something else totally despicable. Yeah. He allowed his wife to serve mackerel with the guts still in them and hasty pudding with goat dung in it. What is that all about?
I think they had finally had enough. You know, when you say, it's funny you say that he beat the student too severely, but he was allowed to beat the students, but they had just decided that he had gone too far. But that's probably because Harvard was founded in 1636 as America's first college. In 1639, these students kind of rose up and said, we're not going to take it anymore. And they forced Eaton out. So that's kind of just, again, that's an example. Everything that has happened in America, everything that's happened in this country has been, you know, America was founded on protests. And on college campuses have been this ground in which these protests have been allowed to succeed and been allowed to kind of grow. So the country and protests and college campuses have all kind of grown up together.
Yeah, Ernie, one of the things I said in the earlier segment is that, you know, as a student at FAMU, we used to march all the time, at least once a year. And it wasn't always, again, we marched over safety, we marched over safe state policy. And then my senior year, we marched about the 2000 election and perceived election irregularities. And I don't remember ever being fearful that by marching, we would be arrested, or by marching, my safety was in jeopardy. And we even in 2000 decided to not leave the Capitol. And we spent the night at the Capitol. People spent multiple nights at the state Capitol trying to demand answers from the then Secretary of State. And I don't remember being fearful that the police were going to show up and forcibly remove us. So what changed?
Well, I think the political climate, you know, probably starting in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama, obviously, proceeding with the 2016 election of Donald Trump, the whole nature of the country's tone has changed. So when students are now protesting, you know, when anyone is protesting, you know, you see all this stuff on viral videos, on social media about how people react and how people are prone to do things and say things that they probably would not have said in 2008 or 2016 before the election of these two gentlemen. So I think that the country has changed and that we students are speaking out more. They're speaking out louder. Students continuously get smarter. They continuously understand what their rights are. And, you know, the police and elected officials are trying their best, and college officials are trying their best to kind of to curb it, to kind of lower it down. You know, we just made the announcement today. We just had a story today that Emory University, which, as you know, your listeners know, has been embroiled in days and days of protests. They've just moved their graduation to Gwinnett County. You know, so imagine if you're a student at Emory University, you've been on that beautiful campus for 4 years, and now your graduation is going to be in Gwinnett County. That's all in response to what's been going on campus. Yeah, so it has this, yeah.
No, they're doing it at the arena in Gwinnett, a closed space rather than outdoors, where they hope to control access. I think it also, Ernie, the other thing that it does is it puts security primarily in the hands of Gwinnett County Police, not Emory University Police.
Yeah,
and I assume that's part of it as well, Ernie.
Yeah, take some liability off. Exactly, exactly.
So, if you don't mind, I want to compare two eras of protests and see what you and Tia both think about this. I'm Vietnam era. I do not want to pretend that I was engaged in great activism against the war in Vietnam. I was against the war in Vietnam. I was in college in 1965, 66, 67, but I was probably as much a spectator as I was a protester throughout much of that period of time. But here's what I think about when I think about that. In those earlier days of the protests against the war in Vietnam, people like me were anathema to mainstream Americans. We were hippies. We were people who had no respect for the law and the like. And yet, it was the protests against the war in Vietnam which eventually, along with what we started to learn about what was happening in Vietnam, which changed the country entirely. Anti-war protesters became the mainstream to the extent that Lyndon Johnson didn't run for re-election, of course. And I want to mention one other thing about those protest days. Saturday was the anniversary of the Kent State shootings, in which Ohio National Guardsmen killed four students, shot to death four students engaged in a protest on that campus. I was at that point an actor in New York City. I was working in an off-Broadway show. We had a meeting the afternoon. This was a Friday. And that afternoon, we brought the cast and the company together and said, do we do a show tonight? It may have been a Thursday, actually. Do we do a show tonight, or do we go black to protest what happened? And eventually, we decided we would go ahead with the show because we thought we had to try to be as normal as possible. All right, so that's my context. America changed as a result of those protests. Ernie and Tia, did Black Lives Matter have the same impact on changing America? As far as you're concerned, those protests, much more contemporary, and which also were massive displays, which at first were criticized, which initially many of the protesters were considered criminals and the like. How would you compare those two different movements? Ernie, you first.
Well, I mean, I think they're similar as well as dissimilar. I mean, I think that I don't know if the country has completely changed as it had when you were witnessing what was going on campuses because of Vietnam. But I do think that it has kept the conversation going. It has shifted some opinions, but, you know, Black Lives Matter is still a very polarizing polarizing concept amongst a lot of people. So I think it's changing, but I don't think it's changed a lot. I think that one of the things that, you know, you talk about Vietnam. I grew up in the South Africa, you know, mm-hmm. when we were talking about apartheid and doing apartheid. And I think that at that point, although I wasn't involved in it because I was on the student newspaper staff, it did change the world, I think, you know, because, you know, a lot of colleges divested, a lot of businesses divested. And, you know, we saw Nelson Mandela come to the country in 1990. So I do think that there is room for change.
So when you talk about even the recent trends with Black Lives Matter, I think I wanted to ask about, sorry, I lost my train of thought, but I wanted to ask about how the protests on different campuses have shifted with one thing we talked about in the previous segment was the pressure on the administration. And now college presidents believe that they could lose their jobs. And do you think that has had an effect? I mean, it's interesting because in that first protest at Harvard, the headmaster lost his job. But that seems to be a lot of fear of judgment on these protests and the political rhetoric from outside the campus, how that affects how the administrators handle the students. Can you talk a little bit about that, Ernie?
Yeah, well, I think that whenever your college campus is overtaken, and I use the word overtaken in quotation marks, so whenever your college campus is overtaken, that becomes a tremendous strain and stress on the college presidents. We know right here in Atlanta that Emory University's president is under tremendous pressure. You know, Tia, you know, when we used to protest on our Black college campuses, our presidents and chancellors were under a lot of pressure to keep us, you know, in line so they wouldn't lose their jobs. You know, Harvard, that, you know, so the Fisk University example that we talked about, the president lost his job. So there is a pressure because you are the leader of this institution. You're a government entity in a lot of cases, and there's a lot of pressure, you know, so even pressure from the university to keep students safe, to keep students from getting killed, or to keep, you know, to how do you take Emory, for example. Bill, you talked about how they're moving their graduation to Gwinnett County. Part of that, as you said, is to keep this thing closed so that there's nothing that's going to break out. There's nothing that's going to happen that the National Guard or the police department is not going to have to be called in to kind of quell something where someone's going to get hurt or killed. And if someone gets hurt or killed, then people are going to start losing their jobs. They're going to start losing their political appointments. It's just so much at stake with these protests.
So let's turn this a little bit into a different direction, Tia, and take it up to your territory on Capitol Hill. Congressman Mike Collins, who has become famous or infamous, depending on the given post that he puts up on social media, certainly has become somebody who uses social media a lot and is known for it. And now he's found himself in a bit of trouble because he has retweeted a meme about a protest at Ole Miss. Tell us what that's all about, Tia.
So there on Friday, there was a video that went viral. Of course, University of Mississippi, also known as Ole Miss, is having protests on its campus like so many others. And there was a black woman who was participating in the protest. And there are now counter protesters showing up, mostly white students counter protesting what is often a multiracial black and brown protest, pro-Palestine protest. And so the protester was black woman. The counter-protesters were mostly white males. And one of them made monkey sounds and gestures towards the protester. And that video was posted actually by a white supremacist. A lot of people were applauding the video, but when it went mainstream, of course, there was a lot of criticism of the video, knowing that calling black people monkeys is considered racist. But Mike Collins was among the ones who applauded the video. He posted it and said, you know, Ole Miss, I think his quote was like getting down to business or something to that effect. And so he was, you know, considered applauding that behavior. I reached out to his people last night. They said he's just pointing out that he is applauding the counter protests. They didn't speak directly to the behavior in the video, but that he is applauding the counter protests. But Ernie, what do you make of this? Now that the protests are now, there are counter protests that, again, in the case of Ole Miss, accused of being racist, in the case of UCLA, accused of being violent.
Yeah, I think that we're entering dangerous territory. I think that, you know, I think that in general, these protests start off as peaceful. They start off as, you know, trying to bring attention to an important issue. In this case, the Israeli-Hamas war. But I think as we continue to move on, as the summer heats up, as graduation comes, people are getting frustrating on both sides, regardless of what political ideology you follow. So I think that we're approaching this dangerous situation where, you know, racism is rearing its ugly head. Violence is rearing its ugly head. And, you know, as we, you know, Tia, you know, Bill, you know, this is election season as well. So politically, this is going to be a very, very tough year. This could be a very interesting year for anybody who's running for office, particularly President Biden, because he has kind of become the center of, he's kind of become the narrative theme of these protests. So I think that as we move on, I think we're going to see more of that.
Yes.
It's funny that I was listening to your conversation with Andrea Young, and you talked about her father, Andy Young, and I'm very close to Andy Young. And we're going to be scheduled to be at Ole Miss next month. So it's going to be interesting to see how that goes as we talk about his life. So it's going to be an interesting summer.
So we should also point out, as we're running out of time, Ernie, you're certainly right that racism is rearing its ugly head. And in terms of Israel and Hamas, so is anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. So it is a real cauldron of potential trouble. We're totally out of time. We got about 30 seconds to thank you, Emmy nominee Ernie Suggs and Tia Mitchell. I look forward to being with you again a little bit later this week as Politically Georgia continues. That's it for us. You can now hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta. Or you can continue doing what you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again on Monday for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada.
You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.